turn on him, to turn on all of them. You might find that somebody in these documents. He patted the pile of paper in front of Fort. If we don't, we'll have to talk about the possibility of giving a break to somebody who has probably actively participated in at least 2 murders and, depending on who killed Ritter, possibly 3 murders. Chase winced. I'd hate to have to do that. So would I. Chase flipped through the documents, pulled the cell phone out of her attaché case, punched a couple of buttons, and said, "Can you come down here?" She clicked off and said to O'Connor and Fort, "I'm going to have my assistant count the money and the gold and give you a receipt that you can file with your warrant return." She turned to Lucas. "I will have him copy all the documents so that you can have them to read. Don't lose them. We'll talk again tomorrow after I've had a chance to digest their content." To the other suits, she said, "You all should get in touch with anyone expecting you this evening. We're going to be here for a while." They all nodded without protest. Chase's assistant poked his head around the door. He looked like what Lucas thought a Dartmouth grad should look like. "Yes, ma'am." Copying the documents took half an hour, with a couple of extra clerks working on it. Lucas collected the copies, and he and Bob and Ray got ready to leave. Documenting the money would take longer. It was not only being counted, it was also being Xeroxed, bill by bill, so that the Marshals Service would have full paper documentation of each and its amount. Fort would wait for that. O'Connor had already left, saying, "Great work, guys." Lucas and Fort agreed to talk in the morning, and as Lucas, Bob, and Ray were leaving, Chase's assistant poked in again and said, "The amount, with today's exchange and sales rates, would be $1,035,620 and 52 cents." "There's a vacation home for you," Bob said. Chase, who'd gone back to her office while the clerical work was done, caught them in the hallway. "I wanted to tell you that I appreciate what you people have done," she said. "This is very useful. We've tried to monitor this kind of activity in the past, but so much of it is done secretly and is classified, and so many documents are encrypted or simply burned that we've had a hard time finding a wedge in. This could be it. This really is something."
"Don't forget about the assassination attempt," Lucas said. "The other stuff may be good, but that's what's going to wind up on the Post's front page."
"We're aware of that. I will be talking to you tomorrow about putting a headlock on some of the Heracles employees," Chase said. "Don't expect it at the crack of dawn, though. We've got some fairly tedious procedures to go through over here. I'm going to try to shortcut them by talking to your friend Deputy Director Mallard, but I don't know if he'll buy in."
"Tell Lewis if he doesn't, I'll kick his flabby ass," Lucas said.
"Yes, I'll be sure to tell him that," Chase said with a second rare smile.
21. As Lucas and the marshals were meeting with the FBI, Claxon pulled John McCoy and Kerry Moore into a back conference room, shut the door, and said,
"We've got a problem. Maybe all 3 of us, but you 2 in particular."
McCoy and Moore glanced at each other, and Moore asked, "What's the problem?" The 2 younger men looked alike and, at the same time, not alike. Both were an inch short of 6 feet and stocky, athletic, with tanned, nut-hard faces and hands. While McCoy was a strawberry blonde, Moore had dark hair. The way they moved made them look like big league second basemen. Claxon took a deep breath and exhaled in phony exasperation.
"It's Davenport. He's back here."
"He ditched his wife?" McCoy asked. "Nice guy."
"His wife is home and recovering. There was a newspaper story in the St. Paul paper.
A columnist named Suchere says he was talking to a cop, and the cop told him that they're now treating Last's death as a homicide, not a suicide. Moore said, shit, how? The Suchere column says Last had a heart problem. He couldn't run half a block. Whoever hit Davenport's wife's car ran a couple of blocks, and fast. You know how Jim could run. God damn it, McCoy said. He stood up, walked around his chair, brushing a hand through his hair, and sat down again. Nobody told us. That's the kind of shit we had to know. Bad intel can kill us. Yeah, well, Davenport's back, and you know what happened next? Jim Ritter gets killed. We got an autopsy report off the medical examiner's files. Claxon had that report in his hand and pushed it across the table they were sitting at to McCoy. Looks like Jim was waterboarded and then shot up close, in the heart. Executed. He was looking right down the barrel when they pulled the trigger. Moore was incredulous. You think Davenport and the marshals did that? There's no proof. All we know is Jim disappeared and turned up in a landfill. But he was tortured first, and Davenport was here, and he's a killer. He's killed 8 or 9 guys as a cop, and some of the killings were seriously questionable. He's always done the hardcore stuff, which explains some of it. The point is, killing isn't something that worries him. We made a mistake when we went after his wife, Moore said to McCoy. When I was married, if somebody had gotten rough with Jeannie, I would have killed him. McCoy flashed a grin and said, fortunately for that guy, he was only fucking her. Bite me, Moore said, but he laughed. He then stopped laughing and said to Claxon, maybe it's time to get a job somewhere else, like Niger. Go up the river for a couple of years, Claxon said. That's one option. The other option is get rid of Davenport. We didn't want to do it because it'd attract attention, but Davenport is the only one who's got the personal animus to keep pushing this thing. Moore was skeptical. So we put a .338 through his heart from 6 blocks away? That'd get some attention, and since they're looking at us anyway... Claxon shook his head. Can't look like a pro killed him. Has to look like something else, an accident, a mugging, anything. We're still thinking pushing him downstream a couple of months would probably get us out of it. McCoy and Moore looked at each other again, and McCoy said, so if he just got sick, I mean, like really sick, you got something that'll make him sick? Claxon asked. No, but somebody might, McCoy said. Moore was shaking his head. That's bullshit. We don't know how to do that. The thing is, we got that lady on the books, the one riding with Smalls. If we get caught, if we get identified, we're looking at the needle. If we're gonna kill him, we do it when we got an exit plan. I'm not sneaking into some fucking hotel without good intel, not knowing where the cameras are, and try some goofy idea like gassing him or giving him chicken pox or something. McCoy said, you're right. Moore said to McCoy, I'm saying Niger. He looked at Claxon. Unless you got something good in Syria or with the Kurds. Claxon said, we're talking about the White House. We put this chick in there, knowing what we know. We can get anything we want, anything. You want $10 million? No problem. $20 million? No problem. Unless she knows a couple of more guys like us to remove that problem, Moore said. Claxon shook his head. Never'll happen. Money is easy. Killing all of us would be way too hard and dangerous. They sat and looked at one another for a while. Claxon stood, picked up the autopsy report, and said, think of something, and I'll try to come up with something. Worse comes to worse, we give you a jar of malaria pills and you go on up that river. Claxon headed for the door, but before he got there, McCoy said, hey, Jim's got a twin brother, heavy hitter, right? He's like a major or a lieutenant colonel, did some work with Delta. I think they were tight, the brothers.
Lieutenant colonel, Claxon said. What if we sicked him on Davenport? He gets caught. No skin off our asses.
Claxon raked his lower lip with his upper teeth, thinking, and said,
That could be it. He wouldn't even have to kill him if he beat the shit out of him or something. Anything that'd slow things down, take the heat off, get people to move on.
How do we find out when he gets here? The colonel. Claxon shrugged.
We'll check and see if Jim's parents were notified. I'm sure they were, so we'll call them up and offer to fly them here. Jim's will says he wanted cremation and burial at Arlington, and it'll take some time to set that up. We'll offer to take care of the Arlington paperwork, but the cremation can take place as soon as the medical examiner releases the body. Anyway, his folks should know when the colonel gets here and where he'll be. We'll brief him, point him at Davenport. If nothing happens, nothing happens.
Hard to believe that nothing would, McCoy said.
He's not one of us, Moore said. He doesn't think like us. You can't predict.
What if one of us did something but made it look like the colonel? Claxon asked.
McCoy shook his head. Wouldn't do that. If he takes out Davenport, he takes his chances. But I won't frame some innocent guy who spent years over in the sand. Moore held up a hand, and McCoy slapped it.
Claxon shook his head and left. From the hallway beyond the door, he called back,
I'll talk to the colonel.
When he was gone, Moore stood up and went to the door, looked down the hall to make sure Claxon was gone, closed the door and sat down again. He leaned across the table to McCoy and said,
Man, we gotta get out of here. This ain't gonna work out. No way, no how.
I think we got some time. Moore shook his head.
No, we don't. If we kill that cop, everything is gonna get worse. If the colonel kills the cop, we'll still get blamed. We're tied up in the biggest clusterfuck in the world.
If we can make it through, though, the reward. The White House, McCoy began.
Moore interrupted. If we disappear, and she makes president, we can come back for the reward. With what we know.
You'd try blackmailing the fucking president and fucking Heracles and the fucking guy who was Army and CIA and would have an office in the White House? Are you fucking nuts? McCoy asked.
We could.
We'd have time to figure out how to make it work.
Moore leaned forward across the table, got right in McCoy's face, dropped his voice to a barely discernible whisper, and asked,
You want to know the worst of it? What I think I figured out?
Do I want to know? McCoy asked quietly.
Moore stayed with the whisper.
I don't think that Marshall killed Jim. I think somebody here did. Maybe Claxon. Maybe Parrish. You know how they're always talking about guns, how they did something here, did something there? When they don't have any more use for us.
Ah, man. I'll tell you something else. I spent the morning packing up, Moore whispered. I got a couple of good passports and bought a ticket to Bogota. From there, I'm flying to Rio, and from there to South Africa, and I'm gonna grow a beard along the way, and then I'm going north. Niger, Nigeria, Libya, there's a couple of mining companies up in the Congo would take us on. There's a shipping company out of Perth that hires security guys to ride their ships up the east coast of Africa to protect them from pirates. The money's okay. You don't spend a nickel aboard the ships. And you don't walk through any passport controls with facial recog.
Ricky did that, the ship thing. He said it bored his brains out, McCoy said.
Ricky didn't have our problem, Moore said.
McCoy tilted his head back, looked at the ceiling.
Let me think about it.
I'm leaving tonight,
Moore said. I'm inviting you to go along. There are some empty seats on the plane. I looked. We could get your ticket on the way. I got a long drive, and you could help out on that.
Where are you driving to?
Won't tell you that until you're in the car, Moore said.
McCoy got pissed, and he snapped.
You think I'd turn on you? Moore said. Keep your voice down. Man, you're not digging what I'm saying. I'm saying that if things go wrong, and they've been doing that since we took the run at Smalls, we could go down for murder. That's bullshit. With everything that happened, it could be a federal case and the feds got the needle. I've trusted you with my life, but if they said, tell us about more or we're going to strap you to the table and give you the shot, I'm not 100% sure what you'd do.
Thanks a lot, good buddy, McCoy said. Moore exhaled in exasperation and said,
I'll trust you with one important fact. I'm rolling out of my driveway at 8 o'clock tonight. I can't wait any longer than that if I'm going to make the drive. I'm leaving all the furniture and everything else I can't get in my safe deposit box. If you don't want to come, set up a new Gmail address, and when I land where I'm going, I'll drop you a note, if you're still walking around free.
Let me think about it, McCoy said.
22. Lucas, Bob, and Ray spent the evening in Bob's room plowing through the Xerox copies of the documents found in Ritter's safe deposit box, as well as the encrypted documents found on his laptop. The docs mostly consisted of bills of lading, along with handwritten notes by McCoy about the contents of the shipments and their recipients. There were also photographs of these people, men in military dress or partial military dress, which appeared to have been taken surreptitiously with cell phones. They quit at 10 o'clock, and Lucas hadn't been back in his room for more than the time needed to pee, take off his shoes, and turn on the television when he heard a knock, but across the stub hall, the room he'd had the first night. He picked up the PPQ on his way across the room, eased up to the door, plucked the spitball out of the peephole, and peeked out. A dark-haired woman was facing the other door. He couldn't see much of her because she was short, no more than 5'4". He popped open the door with his left hand. He kept the PPQ in his right, turned away from the door. He didn't want to frighten her if she was a hotel employee. Startled, she turned quickly, and he realized that she had no mouth or nose, only black eyes and eyebrows. About the time he realized she was wearing a military desert camo face mask, he also saw her long-barreled pistol coming up, a pistol with a wicked-looking silencer, and he slammed the door and fell on his back as the first slugs smashed through it. He rolled to his right toward the bathroom door and fired off a single shot, and three fast shots smashed back at him through the hall door, but now he was in the bathroom and he fired another shot through the door. The incoming shots were loud, silencers reducing the sound of the blasts, but not eliminating it. His outgoing shots, on the other hand, were deafening. The incoming shots stopped, and a door slammed, and he thought she was probably running. He got on his knees, ready to fire, cracked the door, saw that the stub hall was empty. He got to his feet and took three fast steps down the hall and, as he did, heard perhaps 15 full-auto sound-suppressed shots in the main hallway, then three fast, noisy pistol shots, another brip of full-auto, and then sudden silence. He cracked the door to the outer hallway, and Bob shouted, "Lucas! Lucas!" Lucas shouted back, "You guys okay?" "We're okay. She's down the stairs." Lucas stepped into the outer hallway and saw Bob, barefoot, in a T-shirt and white boxer shorts. He was pointing down the hall, and Lucas looked past him toward the exit sign. Seconds later, Ray, wrapped in a bathrobe, burst into the hall with a gun in her hand, saw the two men, and shouted, "Where'd he go?" Bob and Lucas shouted at the same time, "Woman! Down the stairs!" Ray and Bob started running toward the stairwell, and Lucas, running behind them, shouted, "No, no, no! Bob, stop!"
Bob and Ray kept going, and Bob shouted over his shoulder, "She'll get away! Stop! Stop, goddammit!"
Bob and Ray, now uncertain, slowed as Lucas caught up to them and said, "You really want to go into a concrete stairwell with an assassin who has a machine gun?"
Bob and Ray looked at each other, and Ray said, "Maybe not."
"She's gone anyway," Lucas said. "She had a suppressed pistol and a machine gun. She's some kind of pro, and she'd have a getaway set up. Let's find out if anybody's hurt, see if the security people have any video.
And maybe call your man Russell and see who's gonna pay for all this shit," Ray said, waving down the hall.
Lucas looked, saw the carpeting covered with plaster dust and soundproofing, the walls scarred with bullet holes, with more holes in the wall at the end of the hallway. A man poked his head out of a room, saw three people with guns, slammed the door. Bob was talking fast, riding the adrenaline wave.
"She had an MP9. It's a rare gun. I've only seen one before this. She had it on a sling under her jacket. I saw it coming up and jumped back, and she hosed down the door. I fired three shots down the hall without looking, hoping to hit her."
He looked down at the carpet. "No blood. When she fired that second burst, I heard her kick the door open."
"Got lucky," Lucas said. "She thought I was in my original room."
"Gotta call the cops right now," Ray said, "or they're going to show up with their own machine guns, and we're the only people around they might think worth shooting."
"Right," Lucas said. "Let's do that."
Another door popped open. A woman looked down the hall and shouted,
"What happened?"
"You okay?" Lucas called. She was.
Bob put on some pants, and he and Lucas ran down the hall, knocking on doors, checking to see if anyone had been hurt. No one had been. Lucas was never sure how many D.C. cops showed up, but it looked to be about 30, right on the heels of the on-duty security man. The full auto was what had drawn them in, thinking terror attack. They'd gotten a couple of dozen reports of the shooting before they even got the call from Ray, who told the 911 operator that there were marshals on the scene and, as far as they knew, nobody was injured. Lucas called Fort, who listened to Lucas's story, then said,
"This is now officially out of control. This is now officially nuts. This is now officially about 600 pounds of paperwork."
"Get to it tomorrow," Lucas said. "Right now it looks like we'll be up half the night with the D.C. cops."
"And the FBI and DHS. You can't shoot up the Watergate pie without getting a whole lot of fingers in it."
At 5 o'clock in the morning, Lucas, Bob, and Ray gathered in Lucas's room, and Lucas said, "She was wearing a camouflage face mask. I've seen them in pictures of soldiers in Iraq. All I could see were her eyes and her body, but I think I've seen her before."
Ray, "Where?"
"That girl in the photo at Ritter's place, the one where she's turning away because somebody's taking her picture."
"You think she's with Heracles?"
"I don't know, but she knew what she was doing," Lucas said. "If she'd come to the right door, I'd be dead right now." Bob nodded and said to Ray,
"You know what that would mean? No more business class, no more suites. We'd be back at Motel 6.
"Let's not even think about that," Ray said, shivering, wrapping her arms around herself. "Tourist class, the walk of shame."
"We're not there yet," Lucas said, "but I'm worried."
Jane Chase didn't call in the morning. She had warned them she might not. Lucas, Bob, and Ray were rousted out of bed at 9 o'clock to be interviewed by three Homeland Security guys, accompanied by a D.C. cop and two FBI agents. They were gone by noon, having extracted everything that Lucas, Bob, and Ray knew by 10 o'clock, but insisting on going over and over the same territory for the next 2 hours.
"Excuse me, but those guys wanted it to be a terror attack," Ray said. If you don't have the occasional terror attack, what are those guys going to do for jobs?
Bob asked.
There you go, Lucas said. At 1 o'clock, Lucas called Chase's office number, but nobody picked up, and he left a long message about the firefight at the Watergate. They got sandwiches at a Subway, and the three ate lunch in Lucas's room.
You see the reporters out there last night? Ray asked. We're national news everywhere. We're probably all over CNN and Fox right now.
Lucas turned on the television, surfed the news channels, and on the third click found a reporter standing outside the Watergate talking to a woman who'd either seen or heard something.
They were shouting in Arabic, clear as day, Allah Akbar.
Oh, man, Ray said, and Lucas turned it off. Homeland Security is handling it, Lucas said, or their PR department is. They talked about the documents from Ritter's safe deposit box and concluded that while there may have been illegal activity at Heracles, it wouldn't directly help them with the Smalls investigation. I'd need a lot more background to even understand the documents. I mean, I know all the words, but I don't know what they're saying. If you know they shipped 20 cases of used, surplus full-auto saws, what does that mean? Is it illegal?
I don't know, Ray said.
Saws, squad automatic weapons, were belt-fed light machine guns. The fact that Ritter saved the paper suggests there's something wrong, else why would he save it? If it's all legal, there wouldn't be any difference between shipping a saw and a grilled cheese sandwich.
There's something wrong with it, Bob said. I promise. That's why Jane Chase said they'd have some specialists look at it.
After a moment, he said to Ray, I'd like to get one of those saws for our equipment bag. Remember that dipshit Willard pecking away at us with that 25? Think about stepping out there with a saw and powdering his whole fucking trailer.
They both laughed, thinking about it, and Lucas shook his head and said, Jesus Christ, guys, try to hold it together, huh?
Lucas's phone rang. He took it out of his pocket, looked at the screen, and said, Speak of the devil, and she calls you. Lucas put the phone on speaker, and they all bent over it as Chase came up.
We've been working through the documents. We can make a strong case against Heracles for illegally exporting these weapons, she said. They show end-user certificates issued to approved users, national governments mostly, along with a few militias in North Africa, but Heracles personnel delivered the weapons to different buyers altogether, including some groups on our FTO lists.
What's an FTO list? Bob asked.
FTO is an acronym for Foreign Terrorist Organizations, Chase said.
She said lists were maintained by the State Department.
What are you going to do? Lucas asked.
The documents implicate Heracles, Flamma, and Intercorps Ballistics, which are all interlocking. The men who actually delivered the weapons are the low-hanging fruit. We can pick them up right now and try to turn them. We plan to do that today. We invite you to come along. Two of the men implicated are McCoy and Moore, who you want to squeeze for your Smalls investigation.
This is dang quick for the FBI. No offense, Ray said.
None taken, but you're right. For us, this is quick, Chase said. We have a problem. Two of the most critical documents, the clearest cases, will fall under the statute of limitations in a matter of a few weeks. That's unfortunate, but it is what it is. So we're going to pick up McCoy and Moore and three other men today, interview them separately, and use their statements, if any, to launch a raid on Heracles, Flamma, and Intercorps tomorrow morning. Frankly, we're planning to use the possibility of a murder charge, those that you're pursuing, to motivate the men we grabbed today to make a statement on the gun diversion case. We're waiting now for warrants for both the arrests and for searches of their apartments.
Lucas, wait. You're not going to promise them immunity?
No.
Not at this point, anyway, and most likely never, Chase said. But these papers open the possibility of putting the whole illegal weapons trade under the microscope. We're talking about hundreds of possible deaths, maybe thousands, not two.
Ah, Jesus, Lucas said. Did you talk to Mallard about all of this?
Yes, and he's with us, Chase said. He thinks you're a great guy and all, but he said, and I quote, get me the guns and fuck Davenport. The F-word was his, not mine.
Lucas said, I understand, but I might have to oppose you on some of this.
We'll be talking to your director, Chase said.
And I'll be talking to Senator Smalls, Lucas said.
Chase said, Lucas, please, I'm telling you. No, I'm asking you. If you want to fight us over the process, that's fine. But please don't do anything until tomorrow. Please. We're putting these men under heavy surveillance, and we plan to pick them up after they leave their offices this afternoon or tonight, so they can't warn the Heracles people. They'll want to bring their attorneys in, but when we begin questioning them, we're going to use what we get for the warrants for the raid on Heracles. If you break this whole thing into the open before we get the warrants, there'll be some bonfires in the Heracles offices tonight. It won't hurt you to wait a day.
Lucas thought about that and said, okay, I won't talk to anyone until after your raids.
Thank you. We thank you. Somebody will call you in an hour or so when we're ready to launch.
Will you be there for the arrests?
I won't be making the arrests myself. I'll be observing.
See you there, Lucas said. Bob said, good. We're gonna do something. These guys, I don't think we need to go in heavy. Maybe keep some shit in the truck, but basically civilian dress.
Ray nodded, and Lucas said, take your Glock.
I take my Glock when I go to bed, Bob said.
2 hours later, Chase's assistant called and told Lucas that Chase was on her way to monitor a surveillance team that was tracking McCoy in preparation for his arrest.
We believe McCoy will be leaving Heracles around 4 o'clock, and we will keep him under surveillance until we can pick him up. You're welcome to observe. She knows you're also interested in Kerry Moore, but we've been unable to locate him. We will serve search warrants on both of their apartments later this evening.
Where is Ms. Chase now? Lucas asked.
She's on her way. She'll be in a communications car at the corner of Wilson Boulevard and North Veitch Street. If you go around the corner on Veitch, we've reserved parking for members of the group.
Lucas drove, with Ray in the passenger seat, Bob in back. Lucas normally didn't like to ride with other law enforcement officers because too often everybody wound up wanting to go to different places. In this case, they'd be more observers than an action team, so it was unlikely they'd need to split up. On the way over, Lucas said, her assistant said they expect McCoy to leave around 4 o'clock. I think they're doing some electronic monitoring. I don't know how, but they're doing it.
Wonder where Moore is, Ray said. Hope he's not in a landfill.
Don't even think that, Lucas said.
Traffic was already tightening up as they crossed the Potomac into Arlington. They turned the corner off Wilson onto North Veitch and found a line of large sedans and 2 Chevy Yukons parked on the right side of the street, and a man in a suit who waved them away from an open parking space. Lucas pulled in anyway, got out, and held up his badge.
U.S. Marshals, here to meet Ms. Chase.
The man nodded and said,
okay, white Yukon.
Chase was in the passenger seat, and Lucas, Bob, and Ray piled into the empty second row of seats, squeezing Ray in the middle. Lucas asked,
where are we? We're looking at 5 men. Luther Franklin, Ray Shelve, Arnold Buckram, and your 2, Kerry Moore and John McCoy. I'm worried about Moore. We've picked up some chatter from Heracles, and they don't seem to know where he is either.
You're monitoring Heracles?
Chase turned her head to glance at him and said,
we have some, resources in place. "Hope he's not dead," Bob said. "They kill both McCoy and Moore. We marshals be suffering some serious butthurt, Smalls-wise."
Chase looked over her other shoulder.
"What? Butthurt? Is that a marshal technical term?"
First hint of a sense of humor.
The Yukon's driver was a serious young agent with a Caucasian-colored earbud in one ear, which made Lucas wonder whether the feds had other ethnically correct monitors.
The man said, "Franklin's leaving Heracles, and McCoy is with him. They're talking. They're splitting up. Ben's on Franklin. Clark's on McCoy."
Chase said to Lucas, "McCoy's meeting his personal attorney at the Corner Bakery Cafe. He made the appointment this afternoon, and he made it walking down the street from his office like he didn't want to be overheard. We plan to approach both men at the same time. We arrest McCoy and give a national security letter to his attorney."
"I don't know what that is," Lucas said.
"It's like a gag order. It'll keep him from tipping off Heracles, should he be inclined to do that. We can do it administratively, but the director herself has to approve. That's why we're running late today. It took a while to get that done. The lawyer, his name's Roy Bunch, can challenge it in court, but by the time he does that, we'll be all over Heracles. Bunch has a general practice that has included some criminal law, and we're hoping he'll agree to come along with McCoy when we take him in."
"Where's this cafe?" Bob asked.
Chase gestured over her shoulder with her thumb. "On the corner. There's a Dunkin' Donuts on the other side of the street, around the other corner. You've got time, you know, being cops and all."
Second hint at a sense of humor.
"I could go for a couple of those powdered jellies," Bob said.
"Ray, you probably will."
The young agent muttered, "McCoy's in his car. He's headed this way."
"Chase,
there's no parking. As soon as he gets to the corner, one of our cars will pull out and leave a space for him. When he gets out of his car, we take him. Then we'll go down to the corner and fetch his lawyer. If he's not there yet, we'll wait. But his office is across the street, so he should be on time."
"Still got time for donuts?" Bob asked.
Chase, "Seriously?"
"Seriously. I'll get a bag and wait on the corner. You can wave when he gets close. Ray can wait down at the other end of the block, in case he runs and gets past your guys. He's supposed to be tough."
"He won't get past our guys," Chase said.
"He sure as shit wouldn't get past me or Ray," Bob said.
Chase said, "Whatever."
And Bob and Ray got out of the car, and as she was getting out, Ray said to Bob,
"Get me a chocolate cake donut."
"'Kay."
They split up and hurried away from the Yukon. Chase watched them go and said, "It's a little hard to take them seriously."
Lucas said, "If there's a problem, McCoy won't get past them. They do this for a living. Ray was a starter in basketball at UConn. She has a degree in art history. Bob wrestled for Oklahoma State and finished third in the NCAA tournament his senior year, which means he lost just once. He has a degree in social work."
"All right," she said.
They sat in silence for a few minutes, saw Bob walk around the corner with a bag of Dunkin' Donuts in hand. He walked far enough down North Beach that he couldn't be seen by a car coming up Wilson, and he waited. At the other end of the block, Ray perched on the hood of a Mustang. The young agent said, "He's here." Two cars ahead of them, a sedan pulled out of its parking space. Chase said, "Here we go." A Toyota 4Runner turned the corner, moving slowly, and Chase said,
"That's him."
McCoy spotted the parking space, rolled ahead of it, backed in. A moment later, as he was getting out of the car, FBI agents climbed out of the cars ahead and behind him. McCoy saw them and did exactly what Lucas had done during the attempted mugging outside the tailor shop. He sprinted away.
A burly FBI agent tried to step in front of him in the street, but McCoy juked again, stuck out a fist, and smacked the agent in the face, just as Lucas had during his almost mugging, and without hesitating, ran back toward Wilson Boulevard and Bob, with a string of FBI agents chasing after him. Bob was standing there, a ring of powder on his upper lip, a jelly donut in his hand, and McCoy, paying no attention to him, tried to blow on by. Bob stuck out his other, empty hand and clotheslined him. McCoy went face down in a heap on the sidewalk, and Bob put one heavy foot on his head. In the front seat, Chase said, "Indeed." A few seconds later, the scrum of FBI agents arrived, and two of them squatted over McCoy's body, bent his arms behind his back, cuffed him, and pulled him to his feet. Bob still had a half-eaten donut in his hand. Chase said, "Wouldn't want to fight the guy who finished first." "Got that right," Lucas said. Lucas, Chase, Ray, and the young agent walked around the corner to the cafe, Ray finishing her chocolate cake donut, the young agent carrying an envelope. They looked inside, and Chase said, "That's him, in line." McCoy's attorney was a thin man, balding, the remaining hair gone white, cut tight. He wore gold-rimmed glasses, a rumpled gray suit, and was carrying an attaché case. He was waiting patiently behind two young women who were discussing the menu with the counter clerk, and Chase took his arm, held up her ID, and said, "Mr. Bunch, I'm Jane Chase with the FBI. Could we speak to you for a minute?" She guided him out of line, and Bunch asked, "What's going on?" Chase said, "We've arrested your client, John McCoy. We're holding him around the corner in a car. We are serving you with an NSL, a national security letter." The young agent handed him the envelope. "I know what an NSL is," Bunch said as he took the envelope. "But why?"
"Because your client is being held on a national security issue. We'd appreciate it if you could walk around the corner with us and advise your client of his rights and consult with him about what he should do this evening. We are taking him in for questioning."
"How did you know we'd be meeting? Have you wiretapped me?"
"We have a warrant to cover Mr. McCoy's phone calls. One of his calls went to you, but we were not monitoring you specifically."
"Better not have been," Bunch said. Then, "Where's John?"
"Right around the corner," Chase said. "Like I said. Would you like to get a cup of coffee before you talk to him?"
Bunch looked down at his shoes, thinking, eventually nodding. "All right, I better get the coffee." 23. McCoy and the other three Heracles employees arrested that evening were interrogated in four separate, oversized FBI interview rooms by four separate interrogation teams, with Jane Chase moving among them. Lucas, Bob, and Ray were not invited to the interrogations themselves, but each of the rooms was equipped with a discreet video camera, and they watched McCoy's interview on a high-resolution screen in a separate observation room. McCoy had been checked by a doctor for physical injuries after being decked by Bob, but the doc found only a few developing bruises, and McCoy agreed that he wasn't badly injured. The interviews were two-part, with the interrogation teams first asking a series of questions, then Bunch and McCoy adjourning to a secure conference room to talk privately. McCoy was willing to confirm some of the information in the documents hidden by Ritter, but volunteered no further information, denying knowing anything about the attack on Smalls and Weather or the related murders of Whitehead and Last. When asked about Ritter's death, he said, "Everybody knows that the marshal did it. Davenport. Jim was waterboarded and executed because Davenport thought Jim attacked his wife." The FBI interrogator said, "Mr. Ritter wasn't interrogated. He wasn't waterboarded.
He was shot twice in the heart a few minutes after talking with Mr. Parrish.
McCoy. I've seen the autopsy report.
So have I. It doesn't say anything about waterboarding because it didn't happen, the Fed said. I don't suppose those documents were given to you by either Mr. Claxon or Mr. Parrish, the very people who'd have the most to gain from Mr. Ritter's death.
McCoy sat back, his tongue trailed across his lips, and he asked, Parrish? What does Parrish have to do with it? The interrogator said, Give me a minute.
He disappeared out the door, leaving McCoy and Bunch in the interview room. A few minutes later, Chase stuck her head in the door of the room where Lucas was watching with Bob and Ray and said,
Lucas, we think we could use you in the room with McCoy. We want you to give him your theory of Ritter's death.
Lucas nodded. Sure.
Lucas walked down the hall to the interview room where the interrogator was waiting. The interrogator asked, You get the idea?
Yeah. Give him a reason to turn.
Lucas followed the interrogator into the room, and McCoy looked up, frowned, and said,
Hey!
Lucas said, Nice to see you again, John.
McCoy said, What?
The way you reacted to the FBI guys, I thought maybe you'd taken a lesson from me outside that tailor shop.
McCoy shook his head. I don't know what you're talking about. You killed Jim.
Lucas took a chair across the table, across from McCoy, and said,
Couple of things.
First, you knew who I was. You've never seen me before, except outside that tailor shop, unless you've seen some photograph or have been doing surveillance on me. How'd you know who I was when I came through the door?
McCoy said, Fuck you.
Lucas said, Second, I didn't kill Jim Ritter. The most likely candidate for that is Jack Parrish. The next most likely candidates are you and Moore, because we know you're willing to murder people, and Ritter might have looked like the weak link. We were about to pick him up on the assassination attempt on Senator Smalls and the murder of Cecily Whitehead. He knew that, and he was probably looking to Claxon or Parrish for help. One or both of them decided to get rid of him altogether.
That's bullshit. They wouldn't...
Sure they would, Lucas said. They're not soldiers like you guys. They're weasels, suits, bullshit artists. I have a cop friend back in Minnesota who'd call them douche nozzles. They not only would kill Ritter, they'd kill you. I'll tell you, John, if Mr. Bunch manages to get you bail... I'd stay far, far away from those guys. They'll kill you in a minute.
McCoy shook his head and turned toward Bunch, who shrugged.
Lucas continued. I think you know all this, by the way. I wouldn't be surprised if you had a whole bunch of documents and other evidence stashed somewhere to cover you if they start giving you a hard time, like Jim Ritter did.
Jim didn't. Sure he did. More than $1 million and a bunch of documents that are going to hang you and Moore and Claxon.
The feds here hate to go to trial without being 100% sure of a conviction. They've got you. You're toast, man. But you might still make a deal for leniency if you help them out.
You're looking for a turncoat.
The interrogator sighed and said, John, you know... You use words like turncoat, which makes you sound like a good guy holding out against a bunch of terrorists. Something admirable. What you're really doing is you're protecting a bunch of murderous criminals.
He leaned across the table and asked,
Have you ever heard of intercorps ballistics?
McCoy glanced at his attorney, who said, Don't answer if you think it might be a problem. We can talk first.
But McCoy said, Yeah, I've heard of them, but that's all. I never had anything to do with them.
I believe you, the interrogator said.
He told McCoy about Claxon and Parrish fixing the sale of inferior armor to the military.
That's the folks you're protecting, John. There are dead soldiers out there, but these guys made a buck off it. Is that where you're at?
Fuck no! I'm not sure I even believe you.
I got the paperwork if you want to see it, the interrogator said. McCoy turned to Bunch.
We need to talk again.
Lucas was walked back to the viewing room, and Ray said,
You look good on TV. Maybe you ought to be one of those talking heads. Interview the Kardashians and shit.
McCoy and Bunch were out of sight for 15 minutes, and when they returned, Bunch said,
We'd like to see some evidence about this Intercore company. We'd like to see it tomorrow. We're done for tonight. No more questions.
McCoy was taken to a holding cell, and Bunch made arrangements to return in the morning.
We'll ask for bail, and we hope you will recommend something reasonable, he said. If you do that, I expect we'll be able to provide at least limited testimony about Heracles and its activities, if what you say about this Intercore company is correct.
We'll see you in the morning, Chase told him.
Lucas, Bob, and Ray went back to the hotel, had a late dinner, agreed that the investigation was looking up, and headed off to their rooms. Lucas was on the last 10 pages of Hyacinth Skinny Dip when he took a call from a clerk at the front desk.
Marshal Davenport, we have a gentleman down here who wants to talk to you. He's a colonel in the army, a lieutenant colonel.
Lucas knew only one lieutenant colonel, Horace Stout, whom he had interviewed about Parrish. Had he told Stout that he was at the Watergate? Maybe. He said to the clerk,
Okay, give him the room number, send him up.
5 minutes later, there was a soft knock on the door. Lucas glanced at his watch, almost 11 o'clock. Bob and Ray were the early-to-bed, early-to-rise sort and would already be in bed. The last time Lucas got a nighttime knock, he'd almost gotten shot. The PPQ was sitting in its holster on the nightstand. Lucas slipped it free, got to his feet, and trotted to the door. Another knock, harder this time. One good way to get shot, he'd read in a novel somewhere, or possibly an airport survivalist magazine, or maybe he even made it up himself, was to look out the peephole of your hotel room. The killer on the other side, peering back through the hole, would know precisely where your body was and could shoot you through the door. Sounded more like a novel. Not that survivalist magazines were any less fictional. In any case, he plucked the spitball out of his peephole and looked out. He could see a man's shoulder, but that was about all. Leaving the chain on the door, he brought the muzzle of the gun up, cracked the door, and was startled enough to take an involuntary step back. James Ritter was standing there. Lucas had seen the very same James Ritter dead on a slab at the medical examiner's office, unquestionably dead. He blurted, "What the fuck?" The man showed both hands, empty.
"I'm Tom Ritter," he said. Jim's brother. His twin brother.
Lucas took a moment to absorb that.
Oh, Jesus, you scared the hell out of me.
Ritter nodded without smiling.
I understand. You Marshal Davenport?
Lucas was still befuddled. Tom Ritter was an exact duplicate of his brother, and Lucas had never encountered anything quite like it.
Yeah. I need to talk to you.
How'd you find me?
I asked around Heracles, and some guys there had an idea where you might be. I came over and asked at the front desk. Can I come in?
Are you carrying? Lucas asked.
A gun? No.
Lucas took off the door chain and backed away from the door, kept the PPQ pointed to one side but still up.
Yeah, come in. Push the door shut behind you.
Like his brother, Ritter was short, muscular, tanned, and dressed in outdoor clothing, a long-sleeved blue cotton shirt covered by a blue linen sport coat, tan nylon cotton cargo pants, and light hiking boots. Lucas began to pick up some differences. James Ritter had a scarred face from a shrapnel wound. Tom Ritter didn't, but carried the same military look.
Lucas said. Take off your jacket before you come in.
I don't carry a gun, not in the States.
Lucas said, take your jacket off anyway.
Ritter did, stepped into the room, nudged the door closed with his foot, and did a pirouette so Lucas could see that he didn't have a gun holstered at the small of his back.
I've got some questions, and I might have some information you need, he said when he was looking at Lucas again.
Lucas had backed up to the desk. He said, sit on the bed. I'll take the chair.
Sitting on the bed would make a hidden gun harder to get at. Lucas sat on the edge of a hard-seated office chair. Ritter might well have been a computer programmer or a life insurance salesman, but he didn't look like that. You had to have experience as a cop to notice he bore the wound spring look of a man who could hurt you.
When Ritter was sitting on the bed, his jacket across his lap, Lucas asked, who told you where to find me?
I've got a story about that, Ritter said.
He was younger than he looked, Lucas thought. The tan put on a few years and some wrinkles, but Ritter was not yet 35.
I'm listening, Lucas said. I'm an Army officer, 3rd Striker Brigade Combat Team, 2nd Infantry Division in Afghanistan. I was granted leave to bury my brother.
That's rough. Maybe even rougher with a twin.
Yeah, it is.
Hard even to explain how rough it is. It's like you lost a leg. Non-twins wouldn't understand, Ritter said in his quiet voice. The people over at Heracles say you shot him.
I know what they're saying. It's horseshit. Your brother was our best way into our case. I don't want to sound insulting, but he was small fry. The last thing we wanted was him dead. The people who killed him are responsible for murdering 3 people now, 2 of them completely innocent. The 3rd was your brother.
Ritter watched Lucas for a minute or two, judging him, and asked, what do you know about waterboarding?
Lucas said, nothing. I was going to look it up on the internet tonight, but I forgot. We were told by a source that Heracles is passing around some fake autopsy papers that say he was waterboarded, but he wasn't. If you check with the ME, the medical examiner, he'll tell you so. Heracles was trying to convince people that I killed Jim.
But you were pissed about what happened to your wife, and you're working for Senator Smalls.
Lucas nodded and said, yes, I'm more than pissed about my wife. If I was sure I found a guy involved in that, he might fall down a couple of flights of stairs, but I wouldn't kill him. I wouldn't kill him, especially if it was your brother. Like I said, he was about our only entry into the case, but he was nowhere near the top of the food chain.
Another bit of silence, then Ritter asked, if you didn't kill Jim, do you have any idea who might have? Specific names? Anything at all?
Lucas said, I'm not ready to talk about that. We've got an ongoing investigation.
Ritter looked around the room, appraising it as if for ways to defend it, and said, I looked you up on the internet. You're a rough guy, huh?
I have my moments, Lucas said. What are we talking about here?
Ritter said, I was passing through Kuwait when I heard about Jim and caught a flight back home. I've got 14 days. You gonna find the killer in that time?
I could, if I could get some leverage on somebody involved, Lucas said. Now, tell me how you knew where to find me, or even what my name is.
I called some people. I went over to Heracles personnel.
I guess you've already been looking at them.
Yes, we have, Lucas said. I know people at Heracles, ex-army guys, friends of Jim, and tapped into the rumor mill. Word is, some guys have been involved in questionable actions here in the States. I've got names, not easy to get, but I'm trusted to a certain extent.
"They weren't questionable actions, Colonel," Lucas said. "The first attack was an attempted assassination of a U.S. senator and the murder of a completely innocent woman. The guys who did it, including your brother, I'm sorry to say, knew what they were doing, that they'd kill her